for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Ireland's first female president, Mary Robinson, regards Edna O'Brien as one of the great creative writers of her generation. She remembers secretly reading O'Brien's Country Girl trilogy as a teenager in the 1960s. She was astonished that O'Brien tackled the taboo subjects of female sexuality and desire, but says she was grateful for the author's insights. Here in the studio to talk about the series' second novel, The Lonely Girl, for this month's Reader's Review, Maureen Corrigan of Georgetown University, Dan Moschenberg of the George Washington University, and Michelle Woods of the State University of New York at New Paltz. And we do invite your conversation, your participation. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to have you all here. And before we begin our conversation, let's hear a clip of Edna O'Brien, the author, reading from the first page of this novel, The Lonely Girls.
It was a wet afternoon in October, as I copied out the September accounts from the big grey ledger. I worked in a grocery shop in the north of Dublin and had been there for 2 years. My employer and his wife were country people like myself. They were kind, but they liked me to work hard and promised me a rise in the new year. Little did I know that I would be gone by then, to a different life. Because of the rain, not many customers came in and out, so I wrote the bills quickly and then got on with my reading. I had a book hidden in the ledger so that I could read without fear of being caught. It was a beautiful book, but sad. It was called Tender is the Night. I skipped half of the words in my anxiety to read it quickly, because I wanted to know if the man would leave the woman or not. All the nicest men were in books, the strange, complex, romantic men, the ones I admired most.
And that is Edna O'Brien's voice. She's reading from her novel, The Lonely Girl, the second in a trilogy. What did you think of this novel, Maureen?
I first read this novel in 1975 when I was in college, and I had just come back from a summer in Ireland. And my head was filled with Yeats and Joyce and Maud Gunn and all of these great names from the Irish Revival. And when I read the trilogy, I remember as it was as though someone had punched me in the gut. This was a tougher voice than what I was used to from Irish literature. And Edna O'Brien is certainly tougher about relationships and women's passion and the cost of falling in love.
And to you, Dan Moschenberg, what was your reaction to this?
Well, it's hard to remember my reaction from that long ago. But what I recall is having an interest in the trilogy in the context of women's literature more generally rather than Irish literature. And what O'Brien brought to that powerfully was an analysis of rural, young rural women moving to the metropolis. And that was original and new in women's literature of the 50s and 60s generally, not just in Ireland.
And thinking, as you must, because you are director of the Women's Studies Program at GW, did you feel that it was a truthful rendition of a young woman, Irish or otherwise, but most especially Irish, moving from that late teenage period into young adulthood?
No, not exactly. In that, it's the narrator is older, and so it's not the truth that she would have had at the age of 21, 22, but it is her truth later on. So there are layerings of truth going on throughout the book. But I have to say, what was most important was that it existed, was that there was the story out there at all.
Huh. Michelle Woods, talk about how you reacted to reading this book.
It seemed, I read it in the 80s, and it seemed very contemporary to me then, growing up in Ireland in the 70s and 80s. It still seemed a very true story for women at that time. Certainly in terms of, if you think of the character, the ferret, who's trying to seduce her in the van as she's escaping away from her father. And he says, "I'm a good catch. I have a pump in the yard. I have a brother who's a priest." And that wasn't all that far away from what women were still driven to expect in the 80s in Ireland. So,
Michelle, tell us about Kate. The book is clearly in her voice.
Yeah. Kate is quite precocious. She's a bright, intelligent young girl, but she grows up on a farm that had seen better days. But her father's a drinker. He's caught, he's trapped in his own self, and he basically sells the farm away in the first book of the trilogy. And she wants to escape that life. She sees her life being stuck in this tiny village and not being able to fulfill herself and her dreams and the dreams that she's read in these books that she's grown up with. So that's why I think the figure of Eugene Gaillard seems so attractive, even though he seems a throwback. He seems almost a 19th century hero, Mr. Rochester. Edna O'Brien talked about this as it was based on her ex-husband, and it was, he was a Mr. Rochester figure in her Jane Eyre marriage. And you can really see that. But you can see why she's attracted to him. He represents culture, Europe, an escape from the drinking, the desperation, and an Ireland that O'Brien described as fervent, enclosed, catastrophic.
She even uses the same initials for Kate's lover to be, E.G., as in O'Brien's ex-husband.
She does, yes.
She does. And what sense do you get from Mr. Gaillard as far as Kate is concerned, Maureen?
Well, I think O'Brien does a wonderful job of showing how the relationship devolves, because of course Kate falls in love with Eugene because of his cosmopolitanism and his power.
How does she meet him?
Well, they meet at a dance, and she's sort of this hopeless, messy type. But she's she overhears people referring to her as the fat literary girl.
Yeah.
And I think he is charmed by the fact that she is so hopeless and so naive. And he's kind of, he wants to take her under his wing and educate her. But look at how that relationship starts to fall apart. He becomes impatient with the fact that she's so naive and that she's so backward in terms of sex. And she finally gets a little weary of being humiliated by him.
Well, of course, Eugene Gaillard has been married once before, married to a very sophisticated, worldly woman who, I gather, lives in New York and is likely going to come and visit Eugene at some point. But, I really want to go back to the beginning of this novel rather than skipping ahead, because here is Kate with her friend Baba. Tell us about Baba, Dan.
Baba is the best friend you could possibly have. She's a bon vivant. She wants to experience life. She is happily not bookish. She is strategic in her relationships. At the same time, she makes pretty much every possible mistake that a young woman can make. And she's actually a great character. In many ways, she is the person who most embodies the dilemma of women's independence. Again, not only in Ireland, in a number of places, and especially in some sense in post-colonial contexts.
Because she likes to break all the rules.
Because she likes to like what she likes, right? Because it's not even about breaking the rules necessarily. She's not necessarily taking pleasure in the breaking of rules. So it's not about taboos. She's going for what she wants.
And expressing herself exactly as she pleases.
Exactly. There's that wonderful scene where they're in Davy Byrne's pub, famous from Ulysses, and she says they have one Pernod between the two of them, and she says, let's look fast. Mm-hmm. Let's look flirtatious. And I think she's important. I think if she wasn't in the book, Kate would be quite a flat character, you know, a very typical bookish young girl. Whereas Baba's the little devil on her shoulder saying, let's do this.
And so why is Baba drawn to Kate?
To me, it seemed a very true rendition of those relationships you have as a late teenage girl, early 20s, where there's a bit of competition. You know, it's not just, it's slightly frenemy-ish, you know, where Baba, she always puts Kate down. She always, so we don't get a martyr figure, which is great. She puts her down all the time, but at the same time, she needs her because she needs her foiled. It's a two-man act or two-woman act, I guess you'd call it.
Michelle Wood, she's assistant professor of English at State University of New York at New Paltz. If you'd like to join us for this month's Reader's Review, we're talking about Edna O'Brien's book, The Lonely Girl. Stay with us. And welcome back. For this month's Reader's Review, we've chosen The Lonely Girl, a novel by the Irish writer Edna O'Brien. And here with me, three people who've not only read but in fact studied the trilogy written by O'Brien. This is the second in the trilogy, Dan Motionberg. He's director of the Women's Studies Program at George Washington University. Michelle Woods is assistant professor of English at State University of New York at New Paltz. Maureen Corrigan is critic in residence and lecturer in the English department at Georgetown University. We do invite you to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us an email, follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Maureen, talk about the reception that these books received, the first, the second, the third. What was it?
The reception was almost something that Edna O'Brien could have dramatized herself. The books were burned. Priests collected each book in the trilogy and gathered them together and set them afire. Edna O'Brien's own mother was horrified by what she had written and blacked out pages. So you really do get a sense that paralyzed Ireland that Joyce writes about and that Edna O'Brien herself talks about so eloquently in these books, that Ireland was still so very much alive in the 1960s when the trilogy came out.
So that the idea of this young girl even falling in love mm-hmm. with an older married man, put sex aside for a moment, but just falling in love was horrific.
Falling in love, and I actually think that you people are underestimating Kate a little bit. She not only falls in love with him, but she lives with him. My God, it's 1962 in Ireland. Kate's father shows up at Eugene's crumbling mansion and demands to have his innocent daughter returned to him because she must have been doped. Otherwise, why would she be living in sin with this man?
And he doesn't come alone. He comes with a coterie of really angry
yes.
men.
Yes, who are ridiculous at the same time that they're incredibly touching.
What do you mean?
What I love about this book is one of the things I love is the way it dramatizes the class divisions. And Eugene is cultured and cosmopolitan. Kate comes from, as Michelle was talking about, that rural village in Ireland. People are not educated. They're not sophisticated. But there is also something very authentic and touching and true about Kate's alcoholic father, almost like Sancho Panza, getting on his donkey and coming to rescue his fallen daughter. There's a love there that's also dramatized between father and daughter.
Dan.
I have a somewhat different take on that. I'm not so fond of violent men. So I think one of the questions, to go back to the sexuality issue, is whether it is in fact sex that is the broken taboo. And I don't think it is. I actually think that the book burning was based on a woman telling the story. If it had been Eugene or a version of Eugene telling the story, it would have been a minor novel and nobody would have cared, and that would have been that. But having a woman occupy the space of the narrator of a novel of sex and sexuality was dangerous. And that danger continues to this day to a certain extent in Ireland and in other countries, maybe not in terms of what you can write and not write, but certainly in terms of, you know, access to women's health needs in hospitals and other issues. So it's an ongoing issue around the world.
And just going to your point about violence, when those men arrive, they truly beat Eugene. I mean, it was not a nonviolent encounter. Michelle.
Yeah, and it was actually based on Edna O'Brien's own biography, right? She escaped with Ernest Gabler to the Isle of Man. They were staying with J.P. Dunleavy, who wrote The Ginger Man. He was a friend of Gabler's. And her father actually hired a private plane, this poor farmer, and he came over with the village priest and various members of her family. And there was a really violent, they beat up Dunleavy and Gabler and tried to get O'Brien back to Ireland. So it's really based on something factual. And it's important to note that censorship in Ireland, the last censored book in Ireland was in 1998. So it's something that was born with the Free State, the Committee on Evil Literature, which was set up in 1922 and went through right through to the 1990s. So it's very connected to Ireland, to post-independence Ireland, was this notion of these evil anti-Catholic books. And I think you hit the nail on the head, you know, with this idea that it was being with a divorced man was the sin. It wasn't even the sex, and that it's a woman writing about it was the important thing. The priest figure says to her, divorce is worse than hell. It's the worst thing that you can do. And I think that's important. It's also worth noting that Ernest Gabler, who Eugene Gaillard is based on, wrote a book in 1946 about a poor woman trying to escape the slums. She has sex with a man, gets pregnant. She's caught into this marriage, but she eventually escapes. She leaves Ireland and leaves her dying husband. She goes and decides to become a nurse in London. And that book was banned in 1946, his first book. So I think that's important to note. There was a whole culture of banning everything that wasn't pro-Catholic, pro-nationalist.
All right. So now we've talked about how it was received in Ireland. What about the rest of the world, Marie?
Well, Philip Roth has said that Edna O'Brien is the finest woman writer. I love that he has to say woman writer, but the finest living
like
woman
Philip
writer.
Roth.
and certainly she's had an amazing career since the trilogy. So I think she's now regarded as something of a national treasure. The fact that the books were banned and condemned at first is actually very familiar to me. Growing up Irish-American in the 60s and Catholic, we still, growing up, I still remember books being put on the condemned list by the Catholic Church. So that attitude toward books, certain books, as being very dangerous because of the situations or the ideas they dramatize, I don't think is just something that we can identify as belonging to Ireland. We've certainly had it here, too, as well.
And tell me once again how old you were when you first read this.
I was probably 21 myself.
And had you known of the books previously?
I had heard of them when taking an Irish lit course. I had heard of Edna O'Brien, but we didn't read her there. In that course, we read, you know, all of the great names of yore, Yeats and Synge and O'Casey. So I discovered O'Brien on my own.
I remember having an interview with Edna O'Brien shortly after her first memoir came out, and thinking how beautiful and how sad she seemed. And that voice of hers that we've just heard underscores for me the wounded passion that's there in the way she thinks of herself, presents herself, and writes. How do your students react to this trilogy?
I wish I could answer that. I've never taught it. I've never taught it. I haven't taught a course that would accommodate it, but I was thinking, as Maureen was talking, that I'm not sure what the reception is over the long haul, because I mean, you consider the availability of the individual novels within the trilogy, for example, and they're not all available. You consider the availability of Edna O'Brien's early work, and it's not all available. You talk to people who are not the usual suspects as I have just in passing, as to who knows who Edna O'Brien is and who doesn't. And it's a mixed bag, including among people who are, if not knowledgeable about Irish literature, certainly care about women's literature writ large. So there's a place still to be crafted for her work.
You know, I'm baffled. Why is Edna O'Brien not, if what you say is true worldwide and certainly here in this country, and there's not a single caller waiting to speak, why is that, Michelle?
I think it's partly, there is real division in Ireland and England. She'd be a very famous literary figure. But I would say I started college in 1990 and she wasn't on our courses. I went to college in Ireland and she was seen as a kind of a chick lit writer. There was all this problem with the whole banning and that kind of element, but also this idea, even the cover, I mean, you know, it's kind of pinkish and pastel. And I do think Philip Roth's comment that she's a great woman writer is very telling. And I think she was seen as being too light, too fluffy in a way. which isn't true, partly because she comes after the generation of Joyce and Beckett, the great experimentalists. And I think because her prose seems to be, certainly in the Country Girls trilogy, very opaque and simple, although it's not. It's, I think it's a very complex simplicity. I think she was kind of, you know, sidelined. She wasn't seen as being important. In Ireland, that's changed. I would say she's probably on university courses. I've taught her at SUNY New Paltz as well. And I do think certainly this trilogy is important, not only in terms of women's history and women's fiction, but also it just tells this great story about a coming of age of the literary fat girl in some ways, maybe a precursor to Lena Dunham and Girls in some senses, you know, this girl trying to find her way and having this conception of love through books. There's also a real connection to Joyce. There are all sorts of Joycean references through this too. And she's very serious about that. And incidentally, Beckett really rated her as a writer as well. And she said about Beckett that he loved Ireland with a beautiful, sad and imperishable loneliness. And I think that probably says something about her too.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, our Reader's Review for this month, Edna O'Brien's novel, The Lonely Girl. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Dan, talk about Kate's relationship with men.
Kate's relationship with men is, on the one hand, Kate's relationship with Kate constantly. She I have difficulty getting at Kate's relationship with men because I have difficulty finding Kate. And what I mean by that is, and this goes to what you were saying about sadness, throughout, Kate, the narrator, tells us that she's no longer in Ireland, that she's no longer there, and everything she does in that context is so overwhelmingly sad. It marks the 21-year-old Kate as much deeper but also much sadder than we might know. So what is Kate's relationship with men? There's Kate's relationship with her father, which I find characteristically violent, not characteristic of Ireland, but characteristically violent and not really tragic. There's Kate's relationship with Eugene, which, thinking of Joyce, is in some ways a relationship with cinema. Right? I mean, in some ways it's a relationship with a man involved in the movies who doesn't live in a book, right? And then there's Kate's relationship with all the various other men in the novel.
So that Kate's relationship with Eugene, you say it's sort of about a movie. It's almost imaginary.
Yes.
It's not really a real relationship. And that's where I had such trouble with this novel. Because Kate's passion with books does not come through as a passion for Eugene Morin.
But it's such a wonderful novel about how we readers can superimpose what we want on reality. And that's what Kate does. She superimposes these heroes out of books onto Eugene, who falls far short of that heroic figure that she's hoping to find in life. I think that The Lonely Girl is another one of these novels that also warns us about the danger of reading novels, what it can do to your mind, how it can mess up your imagination.
Michelle.
I completely agree. I mean, she says on the first page, I like men in books. They're far more complex. We heard her read it. And it's really interesting because at one point he mentions, Eugene Gaillard mentions Anna Karenina.
Yes.
She says, is that an actress? Yes. Is that his sister? She can't. But later in the book, we see her reading it. She's by the fire and she opens the first chapter of Anna Karenina. And we can read that how how we will. I mean, it's obviously a tragic book, a tragic ending, the 19th century heroine caught into a destiny that she kind of fulfills in some ways. And does that then speak to that danger that Maureen was talking about?
So is Eugene interested in creating his own Pygmalion? And when she falls short of his imagination, he's done. He's finished.
Absolutely. I think Pygmalion, of course, Shaw is a great analogy. I think he thinks he can educate her. She knows nothing. He's giving her everything. And in real life, that was the case with Ernest Gabler and Edna O'Brien, where, you know, he had a huge best-selling success with his second novel in America called The Plymouth Adventure. It was made into a movie with Spencer Tracy and Jean Tierney. He made a ton of money. And so he was the successful author. She
had written
nothing
by then.
Yeah.
I see. Really fascinating. We do have lines filled now. When we come back, we'll take your calls.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Chris Hayes, the former host of the MSNBC morning show Up, talks with us about moving from weekends to weeknights with his new show, how he learned to deal with conflict on TV, and how he approaches the discussions he moderates.
Simmer, not boil, which is our ideal space for a conversation.
Join us.
And welcome back. A number of you have asked about the trilogy written by Edna O'Brien. We are talking about the second in the trilogy. It's titled The Lonely Girl. You cannot buy the first in the trilogy, titled The Country Girls, on its own. You must buy the whole trilogy, and that's unfortunate. Perhaps publishers will change that, because Edna O'Brien's own memoir, titled Country Girl, a memoir, will come out on April 30, and that is next month. Let's open the phones to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Matt. You're on the air.
Hello, Diane. Thank you for having me on.
Certainly.
I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller.
I was really pleasantly
surprised to hear this conversation today, because I'm actually reviewing Country Girl, the memoir, for the Dallas Morning News. I'm in the process of reading it right now. And one thing I wanted to comment on is I think one of the reasons why the reception of The Country Girls and The Lonely Girl and the trilogy in general, the kind of reception received in Ireland, was because so much of it she represents in the memoir as being actually true. The scene, for example, when Eugene, you all were talking about earlier, when Eugene comes, when her father comes to collect her from Eugene's house with some of her other relatives, I mean, she represents that scene in the memoir as being pretty much precisely, that's exactly the way it happened. And I think there's something about, especially in when it's written in the first person, anytime you have a story that represents a coming-of-age story, a sexual awakening, young adulthood by an author, especially, you know, I think with a woman, there's a sort of an assumed autobiographical angle that I think the audience, the readership, sort of assumes. So I think that part of the reception was not just based on here was a young woman writing about these kinds of things, but here was a young woman that was essentially exposing her own life and her own family.
Yes.
And, you know, and her mother marked out in the memoir, she talks about her mother marking out those sections in the novel, and she was marking out the sections that were true. That was the thing that was so, you know, horrifying to her, that she sort of had aired the laundry of the family. But one other thing I'd like to sort of comment, and maybe your guests could talk about this, I don't think you talked too much about it, that the quote from Philip Roth you've mentioned, and I think one of the things, clearly there are many aspects to her work that make her exceptional, but one thing that I found most sort of startling and impressive to me was her prose style. It's remarkably clear and lucid, and as far as you know, word choice or syntax, it's not particularly tortured or exotic, but it has this great rhythm and balance to it. And its sentences, you know, it reminds me of people like Fitzgerald or John Cheever, the sentences you want to read aloud.
Hmm.
And also the lack of irony or insincerity or sarcasm. I mean, the memoir is just a remarkable piece of complete, you know, sincerity and the perception that comes across as of utter honesty. And I think her prose style in particular, line to line, is also something that perhaps should be mentioned here.
Well, Matt, it certainly sounds as though you have your review written. Maureen, do you want to comment?
You know, one thing that I know Edna O'Brien has talked about is that when she was thinking of beginning to write The Country Girls, she had gone to a talk by Arthur Meisner, who was Fitzgerald's first biographer. And hearing Meisner read from Fitzgerald and also Hemingway, since he was mentioning Hemingway that night, really inspired her that one could write sentences that had lyricism but that were direct. And I think you find that certainly in Edna O'Brien's prose. And one thing I'll quickly interject, O'Brien mentions Tender is the Night on the first page, as we heard, of this book. Fitzgerald was out of print when he died in 1940 at the age of 44. And so I think realizing that people's reputations can sort of ebb and flow,
right. That
maybe we can take hope that Edna O'Brien, too, her stocks will rise.
Absolutely. I agree. And I think, you know, when it was all republished in the 80s, I think this is when postmodernism had taken hold and everyone was into their complex language. And because of Joyce and Beckett and so on, that she wasn't seen as being great because she didn't have this experimental style. But it is, in a certain way, the prose is very lucid. And you're right, she did say that when she went to this lecture on Fitzgerald, she'd been writing all this purple prose, but now she saw there was a way to talk about her life.
Interesting.
And there are these beautiful bursts of lyricism that work in the novel because they're spaced out.
But they're about nature.
Exactly.
They're not
exactly
about human beings. They're
exactly
about nature, which I found fascinating. I mean, she sort of saved that lyricism to talk about water flowing or trees in bloom or a valley or something of that sort.
But it's not real nature at the same time, right? I mean, it's a nature that comes out of the Romantic poets, but it doesn't come out of Irish social reality of the day. I mean, what's going on in Ireland in terms of those who are working the nature is completely other than what she's describing. She's describing a kind of Wordsworthian nature, a kind of nature that is somehow a symbol of innocence. And that is not the nature that she grew up in.
Through her own vision and being in love and being of a romantic inclination, what comes out sounds exactly that way. But, you know, that was another thing that bothered me. It seemed inconsistent. It seemed inconsistent that she should write about the landscape in this way and yet be so recalcitrant in her emotional interaction with Eugene, which was almost laconic.
But I think it's also that she's really innocent.
She's
no
shy.
Idea of what, you know, and I think what's beautifully handled in the novel is the idea that they sleep together a few times before they actually have sex. And it's so innocent. And she talks about seeing his member as a flower. It's this really, and I kind of get that. I think as a young, innocent girl, you know, how do you approach something that's really, especially in Ireland in the 60s was really, and 50s was really, you never heard anything about it.
Of course.
And then suddenly you have to engage with the other sex. And I think there's a certain, it's slightly lyrical actually when they finally do get into bed.
Indeed.
And it's quite beautiful.
Indeed.
And not brutal, not like the brutality of the farm with the cow, with the calf and so on.
You know, right. To Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning, Caroline.
Good morning, Diane. I'm thrilled by your program, always.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I just wanted to make one point, and that was that two of your guests looked at the violence, or the violence when Kate's father came to take her back, and seeing it from the point of view of today's society, we abhor this kind of typically now outdated male violence. But if you look at it from the vantage point of the time and place, it seems to me there's a touching aspect to the father's violence in the situation, because it's his duty, it's proof of his membership in the society in which he lived. And in that sense, I do find it touching.
But how inconsistent is he, this alcoholic, miserable man who, you know, doesn't earn a penny, but that he doesn't spend it on alcohol? I have very little feeling of affection or sadness, or certainly not respect.
Yeah, I think your caller did hit on something, though, that this idea that, you know, he has to live up to the society he's in. He has to show that he's doing something, because otherwise the shame will then fall onto his family, you know. And I think it's interesting. It's really pathetic and sad, you know, that he asks for a drink. That's the first thing they do when they come in to beat up Eugene, is they want some booze.
Yeah.
And I think it's part of, it's seen as almost this carnivalesque type, this strange, grotesque kind of, well, this is what we do.
And
this is how we fulfill honor in this society.
Apparently, from her memoir, is exactly what happened, Dan.
Yeah, but at the same time, you want to be careful about alibis for honor beatings.
You want to be careful about suggesting
absolutely, in a different way that the women and some of the men of the time weren't disturbed by the code of honor that traumatized whole populations, that turned women into disposable populations.
And still goes on.
Exactly.
Maureen.
But one thing that I would throw in, and this is not a defense of violence, but you have to remember that Kate's father doesn't have language. He doesn't have words. That's not where his power derives from. Eugene can talk his way out of situations, and he can gain superiority by being fast on his feet with language. Where Kate comes from, the men and the women are practically mute. And when she goes back to her father's farm, people barely speak. They don't have that gift of words that she's trying to acquire through her reading.
That's an interesting point. Let's go now to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Thank you for this show. I was so excited to hear it. I read the book, the whole trilogy, in fact, when I was a freshman at UC Berkeley in 1988. And it had such an influence on me. I identified so much with Kate as a character. there was some similarities in my upbringing, and I hadn't yet had all of the awakening experiences that she was going to have, but it was just, I ate it up. And over the years after that, I would reread the whole trilogy, probably about once a year, and I underlined it, and it was just a really important influence for me. But the interesting thing about it is, after a certain amount of time when I had matured and had some experiences, I came to see it as kind of holding me back, because it defined a woman's life as being so focused on her relationship with a man. You know, that was the most important thing, the only thing that mattered, the measure of success, and it wasn't about anything else, having adventures or ambitions or a career of one's own. So while it was liberating and feminist in a way for me at first, I came to see it as regressive, and I eventually actually, you know, gave the book away in one of my moves. Now I'm sorry, now I'd like to have it back.
Well,
but it's interesting how it changed.
Yeah, and of course, before long you'll have access to the new memoir. It, you know, maybe it is a book you read at a certain age, and then, and you can identify at a certain stage of your life, and then maybe you move on, Dan.
Maybe. On the other hand, and this goes actually to an earlier caller as well, I think there is great irony in the sadness of the book. There are all of these moments in which the writer is saying to us, this is not the story. The way this story is being told is not the story. I have, she says at one point, I have this one cork and it's the only thing I have left that I call my own. The story is the story of women's autonomy and women's ownership of property as well as of self. And that story, the young Kate doesn't know, the Kate who's living the story we're reading. But that story happened in the past. And the actual story, if you like, of the story is sown throughout the book in ways that are easy to avoid.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. You know, we've talked about the fact that Kate's father and entourage show up. And they show up because Kate's father has received an anonymous letter telling him that Kate is living in effect in sin with Eugene Gaillard. Who wrote that letter?
I think you can make several guesses at
Please.
It. And I think it's also a culture of surveillance. Even when she's in prison, she goes back home. There's Mad Maura is there looking at her. Everyone's watching her. And I think that's very true to life in Ireland, you know, right up to the 80s. I think the sense that you were being watched, you had to go to church and so on. I think there's also another element, if I can just say, about Eugene Gaillard, is that there are implications, as Ernst Gabler was, that there's Jewish blood in him. There's some anti-Semitism going on when they come, the group of them come, and they talk about his big nose and that he's a foreigner. So he's not only divorced, but he's also not Catholic. And I think that's a huge element in the novel. And with this secret letter writer, you know, is it Baba? Could it be Baba? Could it be someone else?
Why would Baba do that?
I think part of this competitive nature, for fun almost. She's a bit of a stirrer. And I go back and forth as to whether it's her or not. I don't know. But
what
it could be anyone.
What did you think,
Oh, I
Maureen?
Think it's Baba. I forget which one of you said that she's the best friend you could possibly have. I don't think she's the best friend you could possibly have.
She's a frenemy. She's...
You know, I wonder if I could ask Michelle a question, though. I'm always puzzled when these women writers who inspire feminism in their readers themselves say they're not feminists. Why does Edna O'Brien disown the term feminist? Do you know?
I think it's such a complex issue with her and a very controversial one, because she was seen as feminist, then she kind of disowned it and so on, that she wasn't, she was anti-feminist. And I think, she's a different generation also. She's in her early 80s. I think feminism came to Ireland really in the 80s. You know, that's when it became a public institution, and when Mary Robinson became president in 1990, it was huge. So it's, I think it's partly a different generation, but partly trying to stay out of the controversy.
All right, I want to take one last quick call. Erin, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Big time fan, first time caller. I'm running into work at Washington University in St. Louis to teach at Ed O'Brien.
Oh, great.
To our students every year and take them to Ireland, and even saw Country Girls play to the Gaiety, and she walked in on the President of Ireland's arm. So she is well-liked by these young people, men and women, and we put her in the context primarily of Joyce and Yeats, and that might answer the mix of lyricism on Yeats's part and realism on Joyce's part, as well as her short fiction. I would recommend Irish Revel and the final parts of that story. I think you'll see the lyricism and realism come together.
Erin, I'm so glad we got your call in. Congratulations to you and your students. Have a great next trip to Ireland. And thanks to all of you, Maureen Corrigan, Dan Moschenberg, Michelle Woods. The book we've been talking about, the second in Edna O'Brien's trilogy, titled The Lonely Girl. Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Reed.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from